Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Michael Pollan is no stranger to the murky world of food production and how we humans fit in the chain, starting with the omnivore's dilemma, in which the writer explored the farms and feedlots where our food is grown. Pollan later examined what the food we eat does to our bodies. In his new tome, Cooked, he takes the art down to the bare bones to educate himself and readers about the kitchen. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met up with Pollan recently as he visited Milwaukee during a book tour. Pollan says he's hoping the excitement he experienced rolling up his sleeves will inspire more home cooking. He calls it a healthy recipe for family, farmer, and community.
I realized at a certain point that this very exciting movement to reform American agriculture and create alternative markets and an alternative food economy was going to top out if people weren't going to cook anymore. Because the food available at the farmer's market, with the exception of the fruit, all needs to be cooked. And the great thing about this new food economy is that it is changing the proportion of the food dollar that ends up in the farmer's hands. So if you buy conventional supermarket food or processed food, 92 cents of that food dollar goes to someone other than a farmer. The person making the packages gets more than the farmer gets. But if you're shopping at the farmer's market, joining a CSA, buying local food even at your grocery store, 80, 90% of the food dollar is ending up with the farmer. So I realized this revolution was going to stop unless people cooked. And then on the other end, as I studied nutrition and saw that nutrients really don't explain a healthy diet, and nor do calories even, and that the most important thing about the diet was who's cooking it. And that was the most significant fact about your diet. You could, in effect, assure a healthy diet simply by cooking whatever you want. I mean, there's a Paula Deen exception in there somewhere, but you always need an exception that proves the rule. So the nutrients take care of themselves. You know, if you're going to cook, you're not going to make French fries for two meals a day. It's too much trouble. It's too messy. You're going to tend to buy the best ingredients you can afford and prepare them fairly simply. And that's really the key to a healthy diet. You know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, and cook it yourself.
The research went on for years, as you mentioned. When did it come to you, the way that you wanted to lay it out, the fire and the air and the water?
You know, what I do in all my writing is try to look at something in its most elemental terms. Cooking, as I looked at it, I found that there were these four transformations, and they happened to correspond to the classical elements, more or less. I did a little shoehorning. Fire is the most unreconstructed primordial kind of cooking, is basically putting meat on fire. And then there was water, which is cooking in pots, which comes much later. It's only about 10,000 years old only. But that changes everything. That gives you a whole new way of cooking. You can combine plants and meat. You lose none of the nutrients. It's incredibly economical. Whereas if you're cooking over fire, things drip in the fire and you lose all that fat and good stuff. Plus you're softening grain. You can suddenly now eat grain, which is a big boon to humankind. And it allows you to keep old people alive because people without teeth can now eat. No, it's true. Presumably, way back then, when you lost your teeth, you were dead or close to it. And it also allows you to wean babies earlier because you've got this mush that you can prepare in pots. And then air is baking. And the technology of bread is really an important technology for the history of civilization. You can't survive on flour alone. But if you turn it into bread, you create something that you can live on. And the reason is that the baking process and the fermentation process releases all the nutrients, all the minerals, breaks down the starches in ways that make them very digestible. So it's an incredible advance. You know, it's the difference between porridge, say, and bread is night and day, because in a pot, you can only get things up to boiling point. It's as hot as it'll get. But bread creates its own pressure cooker. And in all those little balloons of air, you have steam, and you're getting up probably to 300, 400, 500 degrees. And so you can thoroughly cook the starches and make something really healthy. And then last is earth, which is what I call the transformation known as fermentation. And the reason I use earth for that is that, like the soil, it's a process of microbial breakdown. And the earliest ferments were just pits, where people dug pits, put their food in it, covered it, and you could get through the winter that way, because the fermentation is a form of preservation.
Part of the buzz that a buzz that I've heard is that, egad, Michael Pollan wasn't a fabulous cook from the get-go.
I was a pretty ordinary cook, actually, from the get-go.
So give us an example of pre-alchemy.
I would make, you know, pasta. I would buy pre-made raviolis and, you know, put a little sage butter sauce on. I was very proud of that dish. But the point is, I was a very thoughtless cook. I just did it. I'm much better than I was. I can do things I could never do before. I can make bread without looking at a recipe book just from feel now. You know, I've done it enough. I can make very nice braises and things I thought were very ambitious. You know, the word mirepoix scared me for a very long time. And now I'm very comfortable with a mirepoix, which is that dice of onions and carrots and celery that we turn into the base of a, you know, French dish.
How does one encourage people to step away from the microwave or to get out of the fast food line? Where to start?
There's a lot that stands between us and cooking more than we do. We are, as a culture, outsourcing it progressively. And we're getting a very powerful marketing message telling us it's too hard, we'll do it for you, we can do it better. All I'm doing is offering a contrary narrative. It's not so hard. It's incredibly satisfying, and it has enormous benefits. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, it's pleasurable. Whether you regard cooking as drudgery or alchemy is all in your head. And we've been encouraged to think of it as drudgery. And I thought of it as drudgery. I thought chopping an onion was one of the worst ways to spend 15 minutes I could think of, you know, short of going to the dentist.
And that was because why?
Well, it's you know, it's hard to do. Peeling is difficult. The thing that and the onion's fighting back. It's making you cry. It's slippery. I mean, the whole thing just was not fun. And but as I learned what was happening, you know, and I spent a lot of time looking at the science of onions. How do they make us cry? What is that mechanism? Why are they doing it? And I learned some good knife skills from some of my teachers. And suddenly what had been this annoyance became a kind of Zen practice. And I stopped fighting it. And I started, you know, I had my little mantra, when chopping onions, just chop onions. And that's about as Buddhist as I've ever gotten. A lot of this is in our head. Now, I don't want to trivialize the real time problems people have, because they do have real time problems, and both partners are working in most households now in America, or at least 60%, I think. It is a challenge, and we have very busy lives. But there's a couple things I would encourage people to ask themselves about that. We always say we're busy, and it's automatic, and it's just kind of who we are. And we do find time, though, for things that we think are important. In the last 10 years, we found about 2 hours a day to surf the internet, do our email and everything. 2 hours that we found somewhere, because the day is still 24 hours long. We took some of it from television watching. That's gone down. And we probably took some of it from cooking. And I don't know where else, from our sleep. I don't know. But we find time to go to the gym and the yoga class, because we know it's really important to our health and our sanity. I'm just saying that spending that time in the kitchen at the end of the day is equally important to your health and your sanity.
Here in Milwaukee, and I know other cities, one of the terms thrown out there is food desert. On the other hand, we have the Will Allen Growing Power Movement. We have a growing number of community gardens. And yet there's lots of people thinking, oh, hey, how do we achieve a time when everyone has the kind of food that they can prepare in their kitchen or a kitchen? You know, how do you bridge those gaps?
Well, look, there's no question that individual choice, voting with your fork, is not going to solve all the problems of the American food system. We're going to have to vote with our votes, too. We're going to need changes in policy to make good, healthy food more accessible to more people and make it more competitive with junk food. Because right now, you know, our farm subsidies support the growing of corn and soy, which are the building blocks of processed food. That's the basis of high fructose corn syrup for soda and soy oil for frying fast food in. And we're doing very little to support diversified farmers. And we're doing very little to support the growing of fresh produce. So we need to address that. But the food desert issue is a very interesting issue. And there is research suggesting that it isn't always the problem, that there are many places where there are supermarkets and the diet is still really lousy. And there's still a lot of pressure toward fast food. And by the way, there's still a lot of crap food in supermarkets. So there's no guarantee having a supermarket is going to fix your diet. And I think what we're finding is that many people in these so-called food deserts lack the skills, even when they have access to fresh produce. And it's not just poor people, it's everybody. We have a generation that wasn't taught by their parents how to cook. There are people who don't know the first thing to do with fresh produce. If you talk to people who work in food banks, you know, they're giving away a lot of processed food, and maybe they should give away fresh produce. I've talked to people involved in these programs in California. They get the fresh produce into the food bank, and aside from fruit, people don't know what to do with it, and it rots in the refrigerator. There is a food desert problem, but there's a kitchen literacy problem too. And that I think we need, in addition to giving people access to food, we need to give them access to the skills to prepare food. And that food security depends on knowing how to cook. Nothing fancy, how to roast a chicken, how to saute some vegetables, these some really basic skills, you know, things that you could do with a knife, a cutting board, and a cast iron pan. And that we need access to those tools as well as to the fresh produce. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, we use this term fresh produce and seasonal eating and everything. One of the great things that the food industry has given us is frozen vegetables and canned vegetables. These are forms of processed food that only have one or two ingredients and are great and inexpensive. You know, we talk about the elitism of the farmer's market, and if your concern is about health, you shouldn't wait till you can get organic produce. I mean, any produce is good for you. The benefits of eating vegetables outweighs the risk of pesticide residues by an order of magnitude. So I think we have to pay attention to the food access piece and also the food skills piece, because I think they're very closely connected.
So are you out to change the world?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm out to change the food system, but the food system and the world overlap in a major, major way. Is central to the environmental crisis. It's central to climate change. It's central to the public health crisis. And it's the biggest part of the economy. I think we need to take control of our diet. I mean, that's kind of the implicit politics. It's a personal political message. But I've found that to the extent I learned how to do things for myself, even things, you know, extreme things like brewing beer, which I learned to do in the course of this, you know, I'm not going to brew all my beer, but the fact that I know how to do it makes me feel a lot more competent, a lot more independent. And once you've learned to insource some of these, so many things that we outsource in our lives, it's very empowering. You could even bake a loaf of bread when you want to. You're able to imagine all sorts of other changes in your life. I think one of the things that's stymieing us politically is this sense of we can't imagine changing anything. We're so dependent on the world as it is and the market as it is. And that if we can build this space of competence around ourselves and do a little bit more for ourselves, I'm not saying everything, I'm not saying all the time, but almost in a ritual way, I think it suddenly opens up. You can imagine living with less fossil fuel, a lighter carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And that feels really good. I think there's some political and even spiritual reasons to get involved in becoming a little bit more of a producer and a little bit less of a consumer.
Are you about to announce that you're going to open a culinary school?
No, you could do better than learning from me. No culinary school. But I think, you know, I've thought a lot about, people have been asking me, you know, well, how do I learn how to do this? I don't know how to do this. Being in a room with someone who's cooking and watching them and helping them speeds up the learning process really dramatically, because so much of it is understanding how the onions in the pan should look and smell when they're ready to move to the next step. So is there someone in your circle who cooks something you really like, who's passionate about making pie or baking bread or makes great soups? Ask if you can come help next time they're doing it. And people will be flattered to be asked. And I think it'll speed your learning so quickly. And if you are a good cook, take somebody in. We need to be trading these skills. This is such an important part of culture, is how do you prepare things? And some of us have it and some of us don't have it. And we need to share it.
Michael Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and his most recent book, Cooked. He spoke with Susan Bentz during a recent book tour. He's posted what he hopes are helpful FAQs and useful links, which we have a link to from our website. Pollan also recommends checking out YouTube for some top-notch how-to in the kitchen videos. His next project involves diving into microbiology, specifically the fermentation that takes place within our bodies.
So I've been learning a lot about that, and I just had my gut microbe sequenced, and I'm learning what is that ecosystem? And so that's where my interests are right now. We'll see where that goes.
Keep listening. From Pollan to Poland, writer Jerry Pollan spotlights Wisconsin's weirdest tourist attractions in a new book. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.